Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
I'm going to talk about openness and the ways in which we fail to understand it. The first part of the talk, I think, will be congenial, will be agreeable to the people at this conference who probably come here because they have some interest in openness in a variety of forms, whether it's artistic openness or cultural openness, openness in the economy, openness in property systems. So that part, I will be flattering your prejudices, and you should be pleased. In the second part, I think I'll be doing something a little less pleasant. I'll be talking about the ways in which we have been complacent and have assumed that technology and history would automatically bring around the world that we wanted. We didn't really need to do anything about it. Openness would be delivered to us inevitably, inexorably, like an Amazon.com package. If we simply waited, history would deliver us second day openness automatically, simply because of the technologies that are around us. Bless you. So, behavioral economists, people who study behavioral economics, have discovered over the last 20 years something that all non-economists thought they knew before, namely that people don't act in the way that economic theory predicts. You laugh, some of you slightly at least titter, but actually what they found wasn't as wonderful and open and humanistic a picture of human behavior. It wasn't that we were complex figures like someone out of a Proust novel or a James Joyce novel. Rather, it was that we had biases and patterns of behavior that economic theory doesn't predict. For example, we were risk averse. We were much more frightened of losing things than we were eager to gain things. Economic theory predicted we'd be neutral, but in fact we're not. So I'm actually going to ask for a show of hands here. Here's the question. Two-part question. How many of you have bought some consumer appliance, a computer, a television, a refrigerator, and bought a warranty on it, a guarantee that says they'll repair it for 3 years or 5 years, because secretly in your heart you knew that if you didn't buy the warranty, it would break on purpose? We all do it. It makes no sense to buy these warranties. The economists approved this long ago. Just put the money in a savings bank. Those of your appliances that break, you can simply pay them out of that savings bank. It makes no sense at all. But we buy the warranty out of an absurd sense that somehow if we do this, it will stave off disaster. There are lots of other examples. Behavioral economists study this and try and find these patterns, despite resistance from conventional economists who said at one point, I have no interest in studying the economics of stupid people. I'm going to propose that there is another kind of bias, another kind of way of behaving that we wouldn't predict from economic theory, which is a systematic bias against openness. We don't expect open systems, open markets, open property regimes, collaboration to generate the creativity, culture, and science that they can. We overestimate the threats of openness, we underestimate its benefits, and we overestimate the benefits of closed systems and underestimate their dangers. I'm going to give you three examples as a test and see how you do. So the first one is an easy one. It's, let's say, 1990, and we're trying to decide how to create a worldwide computer network. And I come to you with two competing plans. Plan number one is of a system that is completely open. It's open in its protocols. Nobody owns the protocols, HTML, TCP, IP. It's open in that anyone can connect to the system. It's open in that the network itself is a dumb network. It will pass any set of packets along. It doesn't care. It doesn't know what they are. And it's open in that it allows for types of innovation on it that we haven't even thought of yet when it's developed. there aren't accepted and not accepted modes of interaction with it. It simply passes on the material. That's network number one. And it's 1990. You're still listening to your disco great classics. You haven't yet thrown away those lovely bicycle shorts that are so flattering. ABBA is still a dim memory. Okay, yeah. It's 1990. The second network looks rather like Minitel or CompuServe or, let's be really radical, America Online circa 1995. It's controlled. You can't get onto the site unless onto the network unless you have permission. You have to be a credible institution, a newspaper or a bank perhaps or a government. You can only do a certain number of things with your computer, no, let's call it a terminal, with your terminal, which has some buttons. You can print and you can read. You can even scroll through and maybe you can jump. That's all you can do. Which network do you pick? I think it's fairly obvious. If you pick the first network, you'll have piracy, check. You'll have spam, curiously articulate letters from Nigerian oil ministers or their sons. You'll have email promising to enhance whatever body part you're a little unsure about. Of course, you get the other body enhancement ones, but you tend not to notice those. Why do they keep sending me that one? I'm kind of puzzled about it. There will be massive amounts of crap. There will be nonsense. There will be flame wars. People will say things that aren't true, and other people will echo them. All true. There will be massive violations of intellectual property. True. People will use the network for bad purposes, for immoral purposes, for pedophilia, to organize criminal gangs, perhaps even for terrorism. True. Which would you pick? I think you'd pick network number two. In 1990, how could you imagine that apart from all of those easily foreseen dangers, which all of which came about, all of which are real. We do have piracy and pornography and spam, et cetera, et cetera. We do have nonsense and gibberish and flame wars and idiots, right? How could you also imagine the Web 2.0 or Google Maps or Wikipedia or open source software developed on that same platform? You couldn't. It's easy for us to imagine the dangers of open systems. It's hard for us to imagine the benefits because they're not intuitive. They're not natural. If I drop this glass, I'm not going to, you know what will happen. If we were in free fall, your reflexes would be disturbed. The internet is like free fall for our economic reflexes. We're not adjusted to it. My other two examples I'll run through quickly. Wikipedia, free and open source software. Again, 1990, I ask you, how would you, I give you the task of assembling the greatest encyclopedia that the world has ever seen. I want it to be in most languages. I want it to cover pretty much everything. I want it to be updated in real time. I want it to deal with current political controversies. I want it to adopt a neutral point of view. And I tell you, how would you do it? 1990, I think you'd say, okay, well, we're going to need a lot of money, probably hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars. We'll have to form a corporation, which will be tightly hierarchically controlled. I think I'll be the head. We need to hire a lot of editors, and the editors need to hire writers. We need to vet the writers. There needs to be an elaborate application process. We need to see who they are, see what their credentials are, where did they come from. Herr Professor Doctor, are you really the appropriate person to be writing this article? Then we need other people to peer review those edits, those articles. Then we need to put them up. We need to control it by copyright because we need to get back our hundreds of millions of dollars that we've already spent. We need to control our trademarks so that no one can claim the trademark of this authoritative version. We need, in other words, to recreate the Encyclopedia Britannica, invented in Scotland. We need to recreate the Encyclopedia Britannica and do it on a global scale. The second person says, we'll have a website and we'll like put stuff up and then people can like edit it. Those are your business plans. Seriously, how many would you pick number two? Come on, as of 1990, even today, right? Even today, you look at Wikipedia and go, how does this work again? Except now it's become a feature of your world. It's become normal. You expect it to be there, and yet it continues to work in ways that aren't intuitive. We don't understand openness. We're very good at understanding the virtues of the closed. I won't do free software. It's the same story. You can see where it would be. Which would you pick between proprietary and free and open source software? It's obvious that no one working collaboratively across nations with the ability to copy freely could create software that outperforms proprietary software. I mean, it just goes without saying. It happens to be false, but it goes without saying. What conclusions can we draw from this? Some of you, particularly those of you who live in Austria, learned to drive in a country which required you to know what to do when there's ice and snow. I unfortunately live in a part of the United States which has ice and snow, but which also has a lot of people brought up in places where there's no ice and snow, so they're extremely dangerous when the snow comes about. Piece of advice, if you're ever driving behind someone with a Florida license plate in snow, stay 500 feet back. Just don't even get close, because they don't know what they're doing. The ones of you who are brought up here know that when you skid in ice, your instinct is to turn out of the skid, to turn away from it. And you know that that's the wrong thing to do. You were taught, hopefully, that that's not what you do, that you turn into the skid. The pilot who believes that the plane is actually turning over in the cloud knows to look at his altimeter, knows to look at his level in his plane, knows that he's going to get vertigo, knows to rely on his instruments and not his senses. We can train ourselves to overcome our biases. The thing is, if open always worked, there would be no problem. We'd just always pick open systems. But open doesn't always work. Sometimes we do need closed control. Open source drug development is not going to get us through a phase 3 drug trial that costs $500 million. It might get us a little bit of the way there, but it's not going to get us all of the way there. Open isn't always going to work for privacy. Open isn't going to work for lots of things that we care about. So the difficulty is that we're going to have a world made up of open and closed networks, and we know, I would claim, that we're bad at figuring out where we should have one and where we should have the other. So far, I should be flattering your prejudices. So far, you should be saying, yes, absolutely, I agree, and I'm one of the people who understand openness. Good for me. So this is the second part of the talk in which I suggest not so good for you, not so good for us. There's a sociologist in the United States called Robert Putnam who wrote a book called Bowling Alone, in which he described how increasingly civil society in the United States was fragmenting, was becoming anonymous, isolated, individualized. People weren't members of groups anymore. People went bowling alone rather than being part of a bowling league. They weren't part of a parent-teacher organization or a scouting group or the Elks or the Kiwanis or any of these strange American organizations that people found to have collective solidarity. And he linked this failure of trust and connection in civil society to lots of social ills. That sounds pretty depressing, but Putnam had an optimistic message. He noted that in the 1900s, American public intellectuals, American theologians, American activists, American union leaders noted that the move to cities had created a new world, an anonymous urban world, in which all of the old ties that existed were fragmented and shattered. A more mobile population, a more isolated form of production, these were breaking bonds that people relied on. And they didn't just sit there and say, well, don't worry, history will automatically correct. History, like the Federal Express box from Amazon.com, will bring us back community somehow. Instead, they went out and feverishly invented organizations like the Rotary Club and the Kiwanis and the Elks. So far as I can tell, as a non-American, the main feature of these clubs is that they involve wearing very silly hats. I don't know why silly hats should be a feature of community, though I will note that religiously that has been the truth over time. But perhaps one has to wear hats. I noticed that even ACMA had the propeller head hat for the geeks, so the little beanie. So perhaps one does have to have hats to have community. I didn't know that. The point is that they invented institutions in civil society to make up for a problem that they could see in their society. And by and large, those institutions worked. They actually did knit society back together again in a complicated and interesting way. So, if we are bad at judging the boundaries of open and closed, we are. If it's very important that we get the boundaries right, it is. Then it is beholden on us to actually create the infrastructure of openness, the organizations in civil society that will allow us to make better choices, that will allow us to overcome our biases. Creative Commons, Joey is the CEO of, and I have the honor to chair, is one such organization. It creates the infrastructure that allows people to share their work. The law was not particularly interested in giving you an infrastructure to share under the terms you wanted. The law didn't offer you that service. That's actually what the Copyright Office said when we said, how do people say that their work is available for sharing? They said, we don't provide that service. We're about locking stuff up, right? We're not about openness. Creative Commons was a hack, a private hack, to say, let's give that to people. That's great. I could pat myself on the back. Creative Commons is a great thing. Larry Lessig, Hal Abelson, Joey, and others have done amazing things, and I'm proud to be a part of it. But it's only one tiny piece of a puzzle that is very large. I'm going to devote my remaining 5 minutes to mention another one that we're building right now called Science Commons. And I do it not because I necessarily want you to enroll or invest in Science Commons, though that would be great, but because I think it might suggest analogies for whatever your area of life is, whether it's education, whether it's commerce, whether it's culture, whether it's art. Right now, there is a tragic paradox in the relationship of the World Wide Web to science. The World Wide Web was invented by a scientist for science. Tim Berners-Lee invents the web at CERN in order to facilitate the exchange of scientific information. The web works much better for buying shoes or porn than it does for finding and exchanging scientific information. If you go online, you assume when you're reading about, let's say, you're reading an article on a blog and a book is mentioned. You expect there to be a link which will allow you to buy it on Amazon.com, and in 2 days, the book will arrive. You expect to be able to share your photos that easily on Flickr. You expect to be able to search for and find a product made in another country by someone who uses a different currency and even a different language and have that automatically translated for you sufficient so that you can purchase it. You just expect it to be there, and it is. You expect to be able to look at the hotel near here on Google Maps, see all of the restaurants near there, and then filter them by what types of cuisine they have. That's just normal, right? You may even have, and this is a really bizarre feature of our contemporary consciousness, you may even sometimes be annoyed when you're walking around in the real world and you're looking at a building. You may want to like right-click the building. It's like, who's the architect? Click, click, click. What's the matter? What operating system is this? I mean, which is actually, I guess, the question that ACMA was asking. What operating system is this? What operating system is this that it doesn't have the right-click function? I mean, what's wrong with that? For those of you Mac people, I'll explain about right-click later. Don't know why it's so hard to have two buttons. In any event, that's the way the web works for culture. That's the way the web works for shoes. That's the way the web works for porn. That's the way the web works for generic information. But it's not the way the web works for scientific literature or scientific materials. Why? Because the vast majority of the literature is behind firewalls or paywalls. In other words, you can find the article when you search on Google, but when you try and read it, it says, please enter your subscription. If you're at a university, then you can perhaps find it a little bit more easily because you can get access to it, but you certainly can't share it with a colleague at another country who's not a rich institution. The key thing you can't do is do what you would be able to do here, which is to build a Google Maps kind of mashup where you say, I'm going to take all of the literature on neurology or malaria. and I'm going to find the common themes, and I'm going to build overlapping maps of proteins or drug pathways. And then I'm going to invite my friends to build on that, and their friends to build on that, and suggest ideas, and to overlay it, to build a Wikipedia for science. You can't do that because it's illegal, going back to the talk we just heard, because it's surrounded by intellectual property. It's technologically impossible because it's surrounded by firewalls or encryption schemes or passwords through which it's illegal to break. And then, even if you could do that, you can't reassemble that and connect it to a standardized set of contracts, like click here to buy the book. Why? Because the way that the world of science works is very different from the way that the world of commerce works. If you're reading a science article and they're talking about a cell line, you don't get to buy that cell line by clicking on it. That cell line is held under a material transfer agreement by a university. You have to negotiate a one-on-one contract, frequently in paper form. You know paper? It's sort of like a screen, but thicker. The point is that the World Wide Web doesn't work for science. We haven't built the open protocols, the links, the traditions of open access, the standardized contracts, the easy methods of interconnection, or the traditions of linkage. Science Commons is trying to make the web work for science. But the point is, Science Commons is just one institution, an institution in civil society that is trying to counteract for our bias about open and closed. And we need many, many such institutions. Thank you very much. So by my watch, we have until 11:36, until my time's done, so we have 8 minutes for questions. So there's a question there. Can we ferry a mic? Thank you very much.
You've spoken of cognitive bias in openness versus closeness and how we don't understand closeness. I must admit I'm one of those people who pat myself in the back thinking I've already learned about openness as an adult, but I see it as something that's been learned or unlearned. I learned about closeness and then learned about openness. And is that bias you speak of a metaphor, or do you really think it's inborn in our brains and we really have an inherent inability to understand openness? Thank you.
That's a great question, and one that I should have addressed. I think there's a simple answer that explains about 80% of it. I can't explain the other 20%, but 80% is pretty good. For most of our lives, at least most of my generation's lives, our experience of property was with stuff like this. If I have the water, you can't have it. At least if you have it, I don't want to have it afterwards. There are real economic benefits to knowing which one of us owns it. We know, for example, in development economics, that one of the biggest barriers to development in less developed countries is that there aren't clear ownership barriers. You don't know whether to invest in this field because you're not sure it's yours. So you might build it up and irrigate it, and then somebody else comes in and takes your crop. With property like that, closed, tangible property that is rival, if you have it, I can't have it, where there are competing uses and where we want one clear steward who can control and be hierarchical, just like the person running the encyclopedia project, the closed intuitions work, right? They actually work pretty well. They don't always work. There are some times where we need openness, like we need roads and open access and public infrastructure, but they work most of the time or much of the time. The point is, in the world of intellectual property, the kinds of property that lives on networks, those intuitions aren't correct. It's not that they're always wrong, but they're much less correct, because I can have the file and you can have the file too. I can have the code and develop my version of it, and you can develop your version of it too. And although there are costs to that, we have Ubuntu, we have Slackware, we have Debian, different versions, it's not as if you making one version destroys or diminishes all of the other versions or stops me from making my version. So The fundamental problem is that our intuitions about property are built in a tangible world, and then we take them and apply them to an intangible world, and we just get things wrong. It really is as if we grew up in gravity, and now we have to adjust to free fall. I think that's the 80% answer. There's a really interesting 20% that I don't think I've explained yet. There's one back there, if we have a mic somewhere.
Hello?
Yeah. I think it's working. I think you just talk and they make it work.
Oh, fine. Thank you. My question is addressing the issue of the expert and the professional. I think one of the arguments that I've been told about not having open source is the fear of the professional or the expert losing their authority. Perhaps you'd like to talk about that.
Well, I do think that there's that issue is there. I do think that the fight between free and open source software and proprietary software is very similar to the Reformation, in that free and open source software, the proponents of free and open source software, are Protestants in the sense that they genuinely believe two of the most fundamental components of the Protestant belief, namely, first, you, the individual, need direct access to the sacred text, either the Bible or, in this case, the source code, right? Unmediated by a priestly intermediary. That's the second part, right? So you don't have to rely on what Microsoft tells you the software does or what the interface is. You need to be able to look under the hood yourself. And in that lies freedom, free as in speech, not free as in beer. That is the belief, that is the self-conception of the proponents of free and open source software, I think. It's that fundamental belief in no one stands between me and the sacred text. And so I do think that for the people who thought of themselves as the intermediaries, that's a threat. Although, in my experience, I have to say, anyone who installs free or open source software finds that they need more rather than fewer experts in order to customize it and make it work. So let me not be entirely a homer for Foss there. I think that there's a problem there. But yes, I do think that's one of the fears. I think we have time for one more question. Do we have a mic for this gentleman? There we go. Thank you, sir.
My name is Dan Restok, I'm coming from Belgrade, from B92 Media Company. My question is, people usually think that if you are for Creative Commons philosophy or something like that, that you are against the capital, against the commerce. So from other side, we have people like Joey, who are also the CEO of Creative Commons, but also very successful venture capitalist. So how do you explain this combination or this?
I think it's a great question. I wish I knew. I also have to note that in my case, though, I would be delighted if my support for the commons was accompanied by enormous capitalist success. I've never seemed to manage to figure that one out. Joey manages to give things away for free and make lots of money out of it. I do the same, and it never works out that way. I just know what the problem is. But I think the answer is that it goes back to the open and closed view, which is when you say open, the only vision of open that we can imagine is charity, okay, which is not capitalist, sharing, community. These are all completely non-sort of, they don't imagine the capitalism. In fact, of course, this is a mistake, because if you think of it, people probably won't like that, even though we're the home of the Austrian economists. But in many ways, the tenets of an open market and a free market are the idea that we want lots of decentralized people without control, strong hierarchical control, doing things, and that will outperform hierarchical top-down structures, right? That's actually the belief, that's Hayek, right? That's the tradition of the Vienna School. But I think we look at whenever the word open is used, and people think, communism, which of course is exactly the other way around. Between the Encyclopedia Britannica and Wikipedia, right, which is the more hierarchically controlled organization? Which is the more top-down? Which is the more dictatorial? I don't think it's Wikipedia. So I think that it's a fundamental cognitive mistake that people make, and I think it's just something where you have to go on, you keep having to point out that, you know, IBM is making billions of dollars out of this, not because it's a communist enterprise, but rather because it sees it as a profitable way of making money. Thank you very much.